Hello, this is Terrence McNally, and this week as 350.org, the organization he founded to fight climate change, stands with those opposed to the Standing Rock Pipeline, you'll hear my August 2002 conversation with author-activist Bill McKibben. My guest today and I both drive hybrid engine cars, each manufactured by a different Japanese automaker. As these wonderful cars and a raft of other recent developments prove, energy efficiency, energy conservation, renewable energy are ready for prime time. Yet, earlier this year, as the world was suffering the warmest winter in history, as people were dying in conflicts across the globe, casualties at least in some measure of America's insatiable demand for energy, the U.S. Congress rejected calls to increase the mileage of the nation's new car fleet to 36 miles per gallon by the year 2015. Now that's 10 miles per gallon less than I got on my last tank of gas. And we're talking about 2015. The Bush administration, when it's not slapping CEOs on the wrists, wink, wink, or itching for a fight with Saddam Hussein, still presses ahead with its plan for more drilling, more nuclear power, and more coal. When it comes to energy, the gap between what we could be doing and what we are doing has never been wider. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect hold pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new and innovative and provocative models in business, environment, health, science, politics, and media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Bill McKibben was a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine from 1982 to 87, where he wrote literally several hundred articles for the magazine. His work has also appeared in The Atlantic, The New York Review of Books, The New York Times, Rolling Stone, and now regularly in Mother Jones. His first book, The End of Nature, was a groundbreaking account of global environmental problems and has been translated into 16 languages. The Age of Missing Information examined mass media and environmental deterioration. Hope, Human and Wild is an account of places around the world where people live more lightly on the planet. In Maybe One, he took on the most controversial of environmental problems, population. His next book, coming out early next year, is simply called Enough. Bill McKibben lives with his wife and one daughter in the Adirondack Mountains of New York. Bill McKibben, it's my pleasure to welcome you today to Free Forum.
Well, and my pleasure to be with you.
Okay. My first question, as it always is, Bill, is about your personal path to the work that you do today and the ideas and the questions that you're focused on. And I invite you to go back as far as you wish, childhood dreams, turning points, mentors, models. I want listeners to get to know the people behind the ideas and the work and the books that we deal with in the show, and feel free to weave the story in as much depth as you wish, and I'll keep track of time.
All right. Well, I wish I could claim some sort of saintly intent from early on, but I can't. My story starts, I guess, as a love story, falling in love with the outdoor world, especially with the woods and mountains of the Adirondacks in upstate New York, where I've spent most of my adult life. The last great wilderness in the eastern United States, and in some ways the most inspiring wilderness on Earth, because 100 years ago it was pretty much a clear-cut mess. Now, after a century of human beings sort of taking a step back, it's recovered to become the kind of Alaska of ecological restoration. And it was living in this magnificent place and spending as much of my life outdoors in it as I possibly could that began to make me meditate hard on the emerging science of climate change in the mid-1980s.
So you've where you live now is also where you grew up?
Not where I grew up, but where I moved as a young man.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as I say, where I've spent my adult life, most of it. And it's the landscape that means the most to me, that is deep inside of me. And it was the landscape that seemed that was the first thing that I understood at a visceral level was threatened by these early initial reports of what we might be doing. The first hint that human beings were producing enough carbon dioxide to begin to transform the atmosphere. I remember the summer of 1988 well. It was the warmest summer across much of the United States that we've ever had.
That was the one with the Time magazine and the parched, cracked earth.
A season of remarkable heat and humidity. It was the year that the Mississippi essentially ran dry. And that was the summer that I was working full tilt on the book that became The End of Nature, which was really the first book for a general audience about global warming. And the deeper into it I got, the more I understood that for me, this represented not only a deep practical problem that we would need to overcome, but more a kind of deep philosophical problem that maybe we wouldn't be able to overcome. The idea that human beings had now grown large enough in their numbers and their appetites to truly alter the most fundamental forces on the planet. Everything that happens on the surface of the planet is driven by climate, driven by how much solar energy is trapped within the atmosphere. The only things that aren't are volcanism and tectonic forces. But except for those, human beings were now materially influencing everything. The wind speed, the amount of rain, where ice and snow fell and where it didn't, the level of the seas, the progress of, you know, the position of forests and tree species and hence of animal species. This realization, you know, it kind of fell on me like a ton of bricks. I remember reading a wonderful line by Thoreau, I think from the essay on walking, where he said that he could go half an hour's walk from his house and come to a place where no man stands from one year's end to another. And there, consequently, politics are not. For politics are but the cigar smoke of a man. Well, that idea of wild places is enormously important to me. Wilderness is in some ways where I feel most at home. And the recognition that in some sense there was no more wilderness. I can walk 5 minutes from my house and come to a place where no human being but me has, I think, ever stood. But if the temperature of that place and hence its flora and its fauna are being radically changed by the habits of human beings, then it's not really a wild spot anymore. And so those two things.
Well, that's let me just stop in a second, Bill. That is an interesting point, the one you just made. You're saying that wilderness even is no longer immune to our
no, you know,
our
for
effects.
A long time, environmental damage was sort of where people happened to be living. You know, it ended at the edge of our villages or our farm fields or something. In recent years, it's obviously gotten more widespread than that. Where we live in the late 70s or early 80s, people began noticing this phenomenon of acid rain, of coal, you know, of the nitrogen and sulfur compounds in the smoke stream from coal-fired power plants in the Midwest drifting east and poisoning our forests. Global warming was the final step in that, the thing that takes it to the final global level. There's not a place on Earth you can go where we're not changing that place. In fact, through a sort of odd quirk of the physics of the Earth, the most remote spots on the Earth, the poles, are even more vulnerable to climate change than the rest of the planet, and that's where the largest temperature increases have been observed.
Why is that?
Well, it's a long explanation
oh.
dealing with the spin of the Earth and how it is that drives weather. But temperature changes in parts of Antarctica have been on the order of 4, 5, or 6 degrees Fahrenheit increase over the last 50 years, and parts of Alaska and other parts of the far north have seen similar kinds of rises.
I didn't even realize that. So, in other words, what we're talking about when we say the planet, a degree or two or something, what you're saying is that at those most vulnerable places, it's higher, and of course, that's where the melting of that ice can have an enormous effect on certainly coastal areas of the world.
That's right.
Okay, so as you were working on that book, you were at the same, I mean, I can imagine the situation actually got worse, or as your understanding of it got better.
Well, you know, I've had the odd, it's been the very odd past now almost 15 years since that book came out, because all the time I confess to being enough of an egotist to have had slightly mixed emotions. Every time that we have another one of these new record years, you know, the temperature, we've had the 10 warmest years on record have all occurred in the last, in the year since I wrote The End of Nature. Every time we have one of those, on the one hand, I, you know, grieve and despair, and that's my main that's my main reaction. On the other hand, there's some part of me that can't help feeling slightly vindicated by the whole business.
I know. I got to share one of my latest similar feelings is whenever they catch a CEO, you know, I go, yeah, but then I realize that he may be caught, but there's probably 10,000 people that just lost their retirement.
That's right.
It's really a chancy time to know how to respond to the news. Let me tell people that you're listening to Free Forum. I'm your host, Terry McNally, speaking with Bill McKibben, contributor to magazines like The New Yorker and Mother Jones, and author of several books, including the one we've just been mentioning, The End of Nature, and one coming out at the start of next year, simply titled Enough. Okay, so you're tracing it up. You've written The End of Nature. You're in the writing of it, is what I'm understanding. You actually realized things were worse than you thought.
That's right. And that, the sort of chain of thinking that The End of Nature launched me on explained much of the rest of what I'd go to work on in the years to come. For instance, the next book I wrote was a book called The Age of Missing Information, which was kind of a meditation on television and the information age. And it began with this question in my mind, why is it that we're not able, knowing this information that we know about the peril that the world is in, to act on it more effectively? And this was an attempt to kind of, I mean, it was a kind of bizarre experiment that this book was about, but it was an attempt to answer that question.
And tell us a little bit about that bizarre experiment. We might as well trace this through the books. But one of the things I remember in 89, looking around, you know, a similar time to as you're writing that first book and saying, you know, it looks like if we are consciousness of the life force, it looks like the life force is committing suicide. And why doesn't it notice and why doesn't it respond? And I remember thinking it's an addiction to distraction. And then when I saw your book about missing information, it felt like it had gone in depth into that very addiction.
Yes, I think your perception is just correct. I went and found what was then the largest cable TV system in the world. It was in Fairfax County in Virginia. And I got good people in Fairfax County to tape for me 24 hours, the same 24 hours on each of those 100 channels. So I had one day in the life of the information age. I had 2,400 hours of videotape.
But it was, yeah, so let me get this straight. It was one day if someone could see everything that was into their home.
That's
by
true.
Having 100 homes do it, you
right.
saw every bit of information that was flooding, that was available to these people
you
on television.
It. You got it. So, you know, I took it home and I spent a year watching it. And, you know, and I was pretty, I only cheated a little bit. I mean, the fourth or fifth time through the kind of Richard Simmons infomercial or things, I'd had enough. But, in general, I wanted to understand what the world looked like, if that was your main source of information. And, I mean, the book is filled with different insights about all kinds of things. You know, it's scattered, in a sense, because I have a kind of scattered mind. But, so there's talk about history and about, you know, our sense of sufficiency. But the most, if you boil everything down, came out of that experiment into one thought, it would be this, that we are reminded day in, day out, 24 hours a day, that we are the most important thing on the universe. That there's nothing heavier than each of us as individuals, and that everything sort of orbit around us.
So when you say we, you mean...
Each of us is individual.
That's right. Not only humanity and human beings.
No, I mean, it would be fairly benign if it was actually society or something. No, it's that each of us is individual. You know, this bud's for you. And that's a very different way of looking at the world than human beings have had in the past. I mean, at other points in human history, something else. The tribe, nature, God, some amalgam of those things has been at the center of people's lives. And because they've had something else at the center, they've, among other things, been able to put certain limits on what they did. We don't have anything else at the center. We don't have any limits on us. In fact, we're told as good consumers that limits should be the last thing on our mind.
Right.
That's why the day after September 11th, George Bush told us we should all go out and go shopping.
Yeah, I mean, if that hadn't really happened, a parody of that would have still seemed extreme. I mean, that idea that be patriotic, spend money, consume. Is this, you assume, I mean, as I'm listening to you, that because the information is coming through television, that advertising is basically the real message of all of this?
I think that it's a mistake to try to differentiate too much.
Oh.
I think it's the just the endless flow of those images. I mean, it's as if everybody in the world has their own little gesture to, you know, like kings used to have, to bounce up and, you know, brightly entertain them at all hours of the day and night. You know, TV spends all its time flattering you, trying to figure out, you know, what thing will tickle you.
What will get your attention, what will keep you tuned in.
Exactly.
So I see, yes. Now, that image of a jester makes very good sense. In other words,
once upon a time, kings were the only people who got to have that
right
kind of view of themselves.
Right. We'd shut it off or we'd walk away if it didn't keep...
If it was, you know, forcing us to see things, confront things we didn't want to think about or to, you know, deal with. I mean, that's why, you know, even public TV looks like it does now.
Yeah. I will share with you, a friend of mine grew up in a family, actually she grew up in Maui, in Hawaii, and they had TV for most of her life, and they didn't watch it much even once they bought it. And she said how difficult it was when she went to college. And she went to a good college, she went to Wesleyan, with, you know, intelligent people, you know, recruited and so on. And she said that basically most kids kept the TV on all the time in their rooms. And that most social situations that were anywhere, there was a TV going on all the time, as well as whatever was going on between her and her friends. And that much of what they talked about and referred to, she'd never experienced. Let me tell people, you're listening to Free Forum. I'm your host, Terry McNally, speaking with Bill McKibben, contributor to magazines like New Yorker and Mother Jones, an author of several books. His first, The End of Nature, was one of the first books to really talk about global warming. It's been translated into at least 16 languages. He's done many since then, which, as he said, kind of all resonate somewhat with the realizations that book laid out. And his forthcoming book early next year will be titled simply Enough. Okay, so I actually, Bill, I like the way you're doing this, sort of how each of your books kind of built on the one previously, I'm assuming, and they're all kind of wrestling with these same issues and problems and challenges. So what you had said there about the age of missing information and the message being that it's about us individually, hey you, you know, hey you, I'll entertain you. One of the notions that when I try to tell people, you know, what would be something that would work or what's missing is an idea of circle of concern, that if people have a circle of concern that only extends to themselves, their family, their company, that we're pretty much doomed, and that even good people, if they don't have a circle of concern that extends larger than that, we probably will not save ourselves. Is that pretty much what that said to you?
Yeah, that's an interesting way of putting it that I hadn't thought of, but yes, that's a good image. I like that.
So, okay, so then we deal with the age of missing information, and obviously inundated with that, it's easier, I would imagine, then to answer that question that you set out to ask, which was, if science knows certain things, and if we are a very capable civilization, why are we not acting in our own best interests?
Yeah, well, I think that at some level that's the answer. We've been trained to be such aggressive individualists that it's very difficult for us to take our eye off that ball, and imagine some other ones.
Let me just ask one question in terms of that. What about in other countries, in other cultures?
I think this was the question that I wanted to answer in this book, the next book I wrote, which was called Hope, Human, and Wild, which was a search for places around the world where people were living a little more lightly. Now, the problem was that it was harder to find those places than one would have hoped. The influence of our way of looking at the world has become close to pervasive. And so you have much of the world broken down between successful versions of us and unsuccessful versions of us. However, I did find a few places that were doing things differently and that continue to give me, hope and inspiration going forward. One of them, I spent a lot of time in a city in Brazil called Curitiba, that I'm sure many of your listeners have heard about by now. Other people have since written about it as well.
So let me remind people, the name of this book was Hope, Human, and Wild. And Curitiba is Curitiba?
That's correct.
Yeah.
It's in the south of Brazil. The city now of nearly 3 million people. It's, by Brazilian standards, moderately well off. By our standards, it's poor income, $3,000 or $4,000 per person per year, and yet it has good reason to claim that it might be the most livable city on earth, simply as a result of just very careful thinking and planning and developing. For instance, they have the finest public transit system in the world, almost entirely based on buses. These buses carry more people than the New York City bus system does each day, and they carry them faster than the New York City subway system carries people.
That's pretty remarkable.
The reason is that they've essentially built a subway system up on the street. They have big buses that can carry 400 people at a time, double-hinged buses, running down a lot of streets that are dedicated to buses. And as a result, everyone takes mass transit. Because of that, the system pays for itself with no tax subsidy or anything. And, probably more importantly, people in Curitiba use about 25% less fossil fuel than other Brazilians. Now, 25% is a big number.
It's huge.
It's not enough to stop global warming. But it's a lot bigger than all the other numbers that people talk about. It's a lot bigger than, say, the targets of the Kyoto Agreement or anything like that. And that they were doing this without any new technology, just by careful planning and thinking, captivated me. I wanted to understand how.
I want to ask you a little more about Curitiba, but I did want to say that is their bus system also have the computer thing that the bus can trigger the stoplights?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. So maybe, I don't even know if you're aware of this, but the city of L.A. has purchased many of those buses. And we now have two, and I'm saying this to listeners, if you've noticed those red rapid, they say rapid on them, buses, they run the length of Wilshire, and then they run also the length of the valley, the San Fernando Valley. Those buses are a pleasure to take, and they're definitely based on the Curitiba model, and they have that computer hookup so that the bus, for the most part, can trigger the stoplights so that if you're on that bus, you will only stop to let on and put on passengers. And it's really a pleasure to ride on them. I recommend it to anyone. And it'll shake you up as to if you think L.A. is no place to ride a bus.
That's great news. And it's a good reminder of that, you know, that we are plenty capable of doing these things. The technology and the ideas are all around us. It merely requires the political will. In the case of Curitiba, there was one man who was more responsible than anyone else, a mayor named Jaime Lerner, who's an architect, and who decided that Curitiba was not going to go the way of other cities around the world.
And at what point what was that?
In the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't going to be this sort of out-of-control urban renewal that was going to destroy their downtown. There had been a plan when he was elected mayor to basically bulldoze the whole center of town and put a elevated expressway through the middle of it, something that you have some familiarity with here in Los Angeles. He said, no, we're not going to do this. In fact, we're going to do just the opposite. We're going to turn the downtown into a pedestrian mall. Now, this was 1970. The only pedestrian mall in the world, maybe, was kind of the old quarter of Munich, you know. There was no South Street Seaport or Faneuil Hall Marketplace or whatever the Los Angeles equivalent of
Third Street Promenade in Santa Monica.
And, you know, so it was a remarkably daring thing to do. And he did it very quickly over the course of one weekend. He had every employee in the city, all the school teachers, everyone down there putting in cobblestones. So when people came to work on Monday, it was a done deal. Now, the local automobile club said, we're going to take this street back for the car, these streets back for the car. We're not going to allow this to happen. So they showed up the next Saturday. They were going to drive up and down this pedestrian mall. When they got there, instead of finding barriers in the way or policemen or any of the things that we would call on, they found that the mayor had the Public Works Department unroll a sheet of newsprint about a half mile down this main mall. And next to it, they'd put pots of paint all up and down the stretch, and there were hundreds of little kids out there drawing pictures. Well, the automobile club turned around and went home.
When you say the automobile club, Bill, do you mean just a club that was local or part of the International Association of Automobile Clubs?
Just the local, all the local people who didn't, you know, who were very into cars,
mm-hmm.
didn't want to surrender the street.
Yeah. But let me just say one thing to listeners that I've learned only recently. At the risk of sticking my neck out into a political situation here, many of us in America belong to auto clubs. It's been a lifelong thing that many do once they drive, once they have a car.
You
want to have that.
Start your car.
That's right. That's right. That when you leave the lights on, you want someone to come help you. One of the things that in the state of California is worth knowing is that that is also a huge lobbying group. And that group may be lobbying with your dollars against your best interests.
Oh, they are lobbying. I mean, it's one of the biggest lobbies in the country, and they're busy taking this money that you send in for your, you know, jump start. They're using it to lobby for more highway funding.
And right.
Somehow that was what you had in mind.
Exactly. And so I'm just saying to people, it's something that it is worth us paying attention to, because the collective money that we are putting into that against our own best interest is huge. And, I mean, you know, as I said at the top of the show, Bill, you have a Honda Civic Hybrid.
That's right.
And I have a Prius. And yet, I'm, as a member of the auto club, lobbying probably against higher cafe standards, against rail, against these buses we've talked about, and so on. So it's just worth waking up and trying to find a way to get your car started when it fails, but somehow find a way not to be lobbying against your own best interest.
This is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my August 2002 conversation with author and climate activist Bill McKibben.
I'm Terry McNally. The show is Free Forum, and our guest is Bill McKibben, a contributor to magazines like The New Yorker or Mother Jones on a regular basis these days, I've noticed, and author of several books, most with themes that relate to environmentalism and the quality of our lives. The first, the bestseller End of Nature, and the next, coming out early next year, simply called Enough. So you were telling us about Curitiba, and by the way this is going, is fine with me, that you're just weaving it through your books and through your realizations, because I have a feeling that's really what we're here to talk about.
Great. Well, Hiroshima was fascinating to me, and because there were people living much more civilized lives than Americans were living, with much less impact on the planet. I mean, it is a great city to just be, you know, be a city lover in. And so I, you know, make my home in the wilderness. I love the city, too. For 5 years, I wrote the Talk of the Town column for the Worker. And this was, you know, Curitiba was just a wonderful place to spend months, just never tiring, wandering around. You could walk endlessly. There were bike paths forever, huge parks. And it had produced in people a kind of exuberance, a gregariousness that apparently hadn't been there before, at least according to the people I talked to. A kind of willingness to be citizens in the way that they hadn't before.
Now, it's interesting. I use the term quality of life, which at this point is almost a cliche. And by that, I usually mean anything that, you know, it might be health, it might be environmental good, it might be, you know, an education system that works. But what you're saying is that when they made these changes in the way that things like transportation and manufacturing happened, that it actually changed the quality of their human interaction?
Right. People, well, I mean, think about it. I mean, if you spend all your time in a car by yourself, you're not likely to know other, you know, all that many other people, and you're likely to sort of be a little scared about them, perhaps. If you spend every day on the bus, going someplace, with just, I mean, you're literally rubbing shoulders with your neighbors all the time. And if it works and it's a congenial and pleasant experience and all of that, over time you just develop a whole different mood about heading out to public places, about considering, you know, about changing the weighting you place on public against private in your life.
Uh-huh, right. In other words, another piece of it is public and then all, even, I would guess, government and so on, that one gets a little different feeling about your civic relationship to others when it works.
Of course, one of the things that you know, that went on in Curitiba that should be a lesson to liberals and progressives is that not only did, you know, people supported the government, but they supported the government because it worked really well, you know. Not just for because they ideologically believed in it or something, but because it really and truly delivered the goods. It was a self-reinforcing system. Each time they did something successful, they sort of got tacit permission from the community to go on and try something else.
Right. Let me ask one thing just about Curitiba before we leave that. Obviously, even any city is going to be perhaps at the whim or victim of monetary things that it has no control over. And I would imagine that when times get a little tougher, someone may challenge the whatever has been the prevailing orthodoxy just because that's the nature sort of politics and human nature. Curitiba would now be in, it would be like 30 years into this, and it continues to thrive?
It's going strong. The mayor is now governor of the state. You know, Brazil goes through far more tough times than good times economically.
Sure.
One of the main secrets of Curitiba, according to this man, Jaime Lerner, who pulled it off, he said, you know, we're very, very cheap. We do everything as inexpensively as we can at all times. And that's true. It's one of the reasons for their great success. There's no gilding the lily. You know, it's a frugal place.
And then you also went to Kerala, correct?
Yes, Kerala in India, because I wanted a spot that represented, you know, that vast part of the world that really is just poor. Not relatively poor, but poor. People in Kerala make about $300 a year on average, which is, you know, way too little. They have way too little in the way of possessions and of stuff. On the other hand, they make almost no impact on the world environment. You know, they're not pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And what's astounding about the place is that when you compare it to all the other poor places on Earth, this province of 30 million people, an area, you know, a population as big as California's, is statistically quite bizarre. Its life expectancy is about the same as that of America. Its infant mortality rate is about the same as ours. Well, it's a little higher than ours, but only a little. Its literacy rate is higher than ours, including its female literacy rate, which is an important number in the developing world.
Very, yeah.
And its birth rate is lower than ours and falling faster. In other words, on $300 a year, they've managed to achieve, in certain terms, a quality of life not all that dissimilar from ours. Now, as I say, they're way too poor, but that's all right. There's room for them to grow. You know, we're not. It's not like we're, you know, twice as rich as they are. We're about 70 times as rich on a per capita basis as people there.
Okay, now how did
plenty of room for us to meet in the middle.
How did that one happen?
Well, very long story, and I'm not completely convinced that I or anybody else completely understand it. But the many components, beginning with a powerful early 19th century movement against of sort of lower caste Hindus, anticipating Gandhi and his campaign for, you know, on behalf of the untouchables by about 50 or 60 years. And so by the early part of the 20th century, Kerala, which had once been the most caste-racked part of Hinduism, was probably the least like that. People had stood up for their rights and in large measure gained them. As the Gandhian moment came along, Keralites were much more radical than people in the rest of India. There was a kind of real strong progressive tendency, the most salient feature of which was what eventually became the most thorough land reform any place in the world. So Kerala has 30 million people, and most of them are landholders. Now, it's a small area, so each of those holdings is small, you know, but big enough to provide a basic living for the people who are there. And so that's one reason that it's developed the way that it has. It's had a long commitment to education. It dates back to Christian missionary times and to the efforts of the local princely rulers of the 19th century. Christianity has always been a strong force in Kerala. It's the very south of India. And according to tradition and perhaps to fact, the Apostle Thomas himself may well have made his way there in the first century. So it's been about 20% Christian, 20% Muslim, 60% Hindu, with a much stronger record of religious tolerance than any place else in India, another factor that's allowed it to achieve disproportionately.
So, in other words, with neighbors not going along with its way at all, it has carved its own way of being?
That's right. It's against all odds, and often having to fight the central government in India. You know, Nehru was not happy about their land reform and things like that, in part because it made it clear how little was happening in the rest of the subcontinent. But they've managed to really do dramatic things.
Hmm. Now, it strikes me that this book, which I have to say is not nearly, you know, did not nearly get the press and notice that The End of Nature or even Maybe One did, seems to me to be a very hopeful book for people to take a look at.
Well, hopeful, yes and no. I mean, hopeful in the sense that it establishes that if we wanted to do something, we could. But on the other hand, not particularly. I mean, it's frankly, in some ways, quite hard to envision those of us in the rich world, and particularly the United States, deciding to really embrace these sort of changes, partly because of that sort of commitment to hyper-individualism that I described earlier. But yeah, mm-hmm. it certainly makes it impossible to say that nothing could be done.
Right, right. In other words, one of the things that one of the questions that I often ask is, there's been a lot of, it is said that other systems have all been tried and failed. right? Margaret Thatcher's Tina,
right.
There is no alternative.
Right.
And I think that propaganda is an important piece, along with all the distraction, that if you can dismiss the alternatives.
Well, yes, and it's important to realize, it's important that we've sort of made, in one sense we're in a lucky period now, because we have a pretty good idea of some of the alternatives that don't work,
Mm-hmm.
A kind of totalitarian socialism clearly doesn't work. It doesn't make anybody happy, and it wrecks the environment and all the rest. Kerala, on the other hand, probably has the most lively democracy in the world, measured in voter participation rates and things like that. It's elected left governments with communist party heads on and off since the Second World War, and it's unelected them, too, at very frequent intervals. And it's shown that in that kind of atmosphere, those sort of ideas can thrive. So I think I think in some ways we're in a potentially good moment. We don't need to be distracted by, the fight against, evils like the Soviet Union or whatever. We can get down to work on things that really do have some kind of future.
Let's jump then to the present. The one question I want to ask, and then I have a aim for the rest of, we've got about 16 minutes. What is the book you're working on now, Enough? What is that?
It's a book about the next great set of threshold technologies that we need to deal with, in particular human genetic engineering, which I think are as much of a, quite aside from whatever their practical dangers may be, represent the greatest philosophical threat that we've ever had to deal with, the possibility of erasing human identity. Undermining all human meaning. It's the only challenge that seems to me as scary and thorough as climate change.
Uh-huh. I wouldn't, it's funny, from that title, I wouldn't have got that. By the way, are you aware of Richard Heinberg's book, Cloning the Buddha?
I don't believe I am.
Huh. Heinberg's an interesting writer. I've had him on the show before, and he one of his books was called A New Covenant with Nature. But one on cloning the Buddha is the sort of the moral impact of biotechnology.
Oh, good. Well,
so give it a look.
Yes.
So let's look at our present situation. The article that I alluded to at the top was an article in the current Mother Jones, in which you, as an owner and driver of a hybrid, and I'm one as well, you look and you say, this is so possible. I have nothing but good to say about that car, and even of people's reaction to it. And yet you make a wonderful line there, which it struck me was similar when I asked, is Hope, Human, and Wild a hopeful book? And I heard that hesitation, in that the happier you are with your hybrid, the angrier you are with what's going on.
That's right. For a long time, let's face it, environmentalists at some level were crossing their fingers when they talked about renewable energy and all of that. It wasn't quite ready yet for everybody to take part. We could have done a lot more to make it come faster, and the people who were out in their backyards experimenting with biodiesel or rammed earth in tires for their houses or whatever were noble people doing important work. But on a mass basis, it wasn't quite there yet. Now it is. No matter what sector we look at, transportation, home construction, electricity generation, boy, we should be able to make enormous gains if we put our minds to it. But we've had a distinctly bipartisan effort since 1990 to do nothing about climate change or carbon reduction. And we're now in the truly disastrous administration that seems bent on not only ignoring the problem, but on sort of willfully making it worse.
Yeah. I let me share with you an image that I had when two oil men were elected to the White House. I had this image of the 20th century, kind of a hand reaching up from the grave, and trying with its last breath to strangle us here in the 21st century as if, you know, I'm not going without a fight. And it feels like that to me.
Absolutely.
That even they can see the inevitability at some point.
Oh, no, everyone knows, you know, the oil companies know, everyone knows that 50 years, 60, 70 years from now, we're not going to be powering ourselves with fossil fuel. If we haven't run out of them, the environmental problems will have become so unbelievable that no one will have anything to do with them. The only question is, how long does the transition take? They would like it to take as long as possible because they're making plenty of money at the moment and they have these large fixed investments in oil wells and pipelines and things that they want to wring every last penny out of. So that, you know, they're perfectly happy if that transition takes 50, 60 years. Those of us who look at the carbon levels in the atmosphere know that we got 10, 15 years to jumpstart, catalyze, accelerate this transition so that we're off oil before, you know, by 2020, 2025, 2030. If we're able to do that, then it's possible the temperature changes we face will be merely horrendous and perhaps not cataclysmic.
Yes.
And that's got to be our task. And, you know, we can do it now. We see where the technologies are coming from. We see countries, we see parts of Europe that are really beginning in earnest to do this work, and yet we're not getting off the dime. The one place that seems to be starting is California.
Yeah.
And, you know, good for Gray Davis to sign that bill. Good for the legislature to get it through, mandating increases in gas mileage. Let's hope that it really works and stands up to appeal and is faithfully carried out by the administrators in California. If it does, it's the first break in the dam in this country, and it'll really get us somewhere.
Well, let me tell people again, you're listening to Free Forum. I'm Terry McNally speaking with Bill McKibben, author of, it seems like there's a Mother Jones article about every other month lately, and books from the end of nature to maybe one and so on, and a new one coming out next year called Enough. California also, in addition to that, has a climate registry, you know, that's setting up already to at least be ready for emissions offsets and so on if that's put into place. And it's interesting that this, you know, when you talk about Kerala as being 30 million, basically we're this 30 million, but we're the fifth largest economy in the world, having passed France recently. And that we have to go it alone is so discouraging, and yet, good that there's someone willing.
Yes, and in fact, it's not alone. There are states and localities across the country that are beginning to do interesting things, and they're beginning to do them in part because it's become so clear that Washington can't, that Washington, on a bipartisan basis, is just gridlocked. But, you know, the only, by far the best champion of all this stuff in Washington right now is Jim Jeffords from Vermont, who's neither Democrat nor Republican.
I hadn't thought of that, but you're right.
You know, my man for president. But, you know, so if you look around the country, you see places beginning to do interesting things. Salt Lake City, which we do not think of as a bastion of progressivity, has announced that it's going to meet the Kyoto targets on its own. Seattle, the same. Things are beginning to happen. The question is, how do we make them happen fast?
And what do you say on that?
I think that it's, you know, above all, a political question.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, it's important for people to go out and buy hybrid cars when they can, and it's even more important for them to make sure that they're electing legislators that understand how important it is to give tax breaks for hybrid cars and start that process right away. And the same thing with electric generation, with energy conservation, and so on and so forth. The kind of numbers we need to change will only be changed with political action, and it's got to be savvy political action. It can't just be, you know, the kind of unfocused idealism that that resulted in, say, the Nader campaign or something. It's got to be a marriage of strategy and idealism that really gets us someplace.
Yeah, the point.
You know, we have one of the useful things about working on global warming issue is that you know, as scattered as I can be and as interested in as many things and as, you know, what ranging widely across philosophy and history and everything else, and you get right down to it, every year we measure how many parts per million carbon dioxide there are in the atmosphere. And that number is still going straight up, and we've got to turn around and bring it straight down, or we are in big trouble. Anything that in the next 20 years results in turning that number around is a good thing, and that's going to mean smart political action.
Mm-hmm. I must say I share the my analysis of the Nader campaign in 2000 is very much the same as yours, which was a couple of things. One was when people would say to me, but you tell us I'm throwing away my vote if I vote for Nader. Well, I'm not. And I would say, no, you're throwing away my vote.
Well, people always say, I want to vote my conscience.
Yeah.
Well, look, conscience is the most important thing in the world. But it's what you should live your conscience every day, day in, day out. You should vote for the guy who's going to get something done in the next few years, you know, because we just live in this period of time. I mean, more power to Ralph Nader. I like and admire him, and I sure as hell wish he'd gone on the TV a week before the election and said, look, if you happen to live in these eight states, I don't want you to vote for me.
Right.
I mean, if he'd done that, he would have been the kingmaker. He would have been picking the, you know, Secretary of EPA and the Attorney General. And this would be a different country now.
That's right. That's
You've
right.
You've got to marry idealism to strategy, and you know, if strategy and tactics and things are a dirty word, so be it. We've got 375 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere, and we cannot let that go to 500 parts per million.
That's right. And that's it. Exactly, though. To be strategic, the idea that there should be a argument or a choice between idealism and strategy is, even if it's always been true or always seemed true, we can't afford it.
I think that that's right.
And we've got to find a way to bring these two things together. Now, do you see, what do you make of the corruption scandals as a potential... having potential positive effects.
I think they're very useful in that they begin to dim the luster of the businessman as our, you know, national icon, and with it the idea that the most important thing in the world is what they think the most important thing in the world is: constant, endless growth and expansion. By tarnishing that halo, it will allow some other halos potentially to shine and people to get some more interesting ideas about what we might be aiming for.
Mm-hmm.
I think that too much room at the top of our sort of agenda has been taken up by corporate chieftains now for too long a time. And this was as true in the Clinton administration as it is now.
Absolutely. And I think you're right that while the stock market may have been disconnected from real productivity and real earnings, it still was the same worship of growth.
Yeah.
And that as the, I think, you know, if I were to say two things I hear, one is the elevation of individualism and your own, you know, just being true to yourself and your interests on the one hand, and then endless growth on the other, that those two things together are probably as describe the American culture as much as anything, and they are ultimately suicidal.
I'm with you. Absolutely.
Yeah. So what, if you could, again, we've got about 3 minutes. What are the things, if we could leave people with hope, what are the things that you're seeing, as you said, Salt Lake City, Curitiba,
hey,
this, give us
world,
some more stuff.
Around the world, wind energy is the fastest growing form of electric generation. It grew 31% around the world last year. It started from a small base, but that's a good number. And it's precisely the kind of number we could build on. We could build on in this country. We're beginning to do it. There are proposals for wind plants and things coming online in a lot of places, sort of following Jerry Brown's pioneering work there in the hills and valleys of California.
Right. I think you say in your article that the winds across our plains could fuel the entire country?
The DOE, Department of Energy, estimated that if you took just the good wind sites in only the Dakotas and Texas, you'd generate twice as much electricity as the U.S. uses. You know, the numbers are astounding.
And that is astounding.
Sooner or later, we'll wake up to the fact that, you know, we're washed in wind every day and in sunshine. The question is, sooner or later, we've got to do it sooner.
Mm-hmm.
And that requires real all-out political commitment. It means every kind of subsidy and tax break and incentive that you can imagine. It means leaders highlighting these things and making real, deep, personal commitments to it.
I think that that's
hopeful. I think there are signs around the world of a kind of, you know, different beginnings. So far, they're submerged beneath the general tide of things. But, boy, they can't stay submerged for long.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the saddest thing, in a way, is that for this country in particular, that a boom time of both financial prosperity and optimism and sort of confidence
came and went.
Was wasted.
Well, for me, the saddest thing was that, you know, the real opportunity to honor the people who were killed on September 11th was wasted. You know, if on September 12th the president had gone on TV and said, look, job one, we've got to catch Osama bin Laden and stick him away. Job two, we got to make sure we're never in this position again. We got to get off oil, boys and girls. And I'm going to make sure by the time my administration is done that we're well on the way. Well, if he'd said that, we were all in a mood to do something about it. You know, someone could have said, yeah, we need a $1 a gallon gasoline tax, and people would have snapped too, and so on and so forth down the line. Instead, we were told to go shop. We went and bought even more SUVs than we'd had before. It was just heartbreaking. You know, people went and put American flags on the back of those things. They should have come with little Saudi Arabian flags you could glue to the bumper. That's the only people who benefit from that kind of thing. And this was the perfect opportunity to show that our environmental interests and most of our other interests mesh. As indeed they, what possible good could be served by the kind of waste of money and resources and environment that fossil fuel represents?
Yeah. Thank you, Bill McKibben, for your work over the last few years and continuing. Bill McKibben has written many books, The End of Nature, Maybe One, Hope, Human and Wild, and one coming out early next year, Enough. Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you, Terry. Take care.
To learn more about the show, guests, podcasts, articles, and so on, you can visit me at terrencemcnally.net. TerrenceMcNally.net, or A World That Just Might Work, all one word, aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. You can listen to podcasts there at iTunes. You can sign up there at iTunes to have the podcast delivered to you weekly. You can also sign up there or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. Get my weekly email telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and three or four articles of background. You can also check out Free Forum with Terrence McNally on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. You've been listening to Free Forum, and this is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
On the eve of the most important election of our time, bring your friends to an unprecedented event. The Stephanie Miller Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour goes coast to coast. Monday, November 7th, the night before the election.
Just one night.
It's a special Get Out the Vote rally with a new original show in theaters nationwide. Starring political comedy radio talk show host Stephanie Miller.
You know, this is where it all began as I started my career as a dancer at the Itchy Kitty in Reseda.
Sirius XM host John Fugelsang.
If you're comparing gay marriage to bestiality, you're not a First Amendment hero. You're a guy who thinks way too much about bestiality.
And hilarious comedy duo Frangela.
Hey, you're back up and you're black up.
Just one night. It's a special Get Out the Vote rally for this very important election. Find your local theater and purchase tickets at fathomevents.com. Monday, Election Eve, November 7th.
In theater.
Get your sexy liberal comedy show tickets now at fathomevents.com. We'll be right back.